Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome to the program for June 15, 2021, which in the Hebrew calendar is the 5th of Tammuz 5781. I am Walter Bingham. It's been another of those unpredictable weeks where the future of the new government hung in the balance. It's been nearly 3 months since our fourth general election, and we still don't have an effective government. Oh yes, in theory, a government has been agreed. But the constituent parties have such divergent policies that they're still arguing amongst themselves. At the very last moment, according to law, they have submitted the signatures of all parties that are a part of this government to the Knesset Secretariat, so that on Sunday the government has been sworn in. Having regard to those difficulties, just imagine the scene when they finally sit in cabinet to try and reach unanimous decisions. Could the left and right-wing parties ever agree on Shabbat transport? Would the draft law, so strongly advocated by Avigdor Lieberman, ever pass 3 readings in Knesset? Or would a building freeze in Judea and Samaria that was promised to U.S. President Biden by the Defense Minister Gantz on his recent visit to Washington really hold, when the idea is to facilitate an Arab state in the heartland of Israel? Among the outline key principles of the new government are several clauses under the heading religion and state, among them creating competition in the field of kosher certification organization, opening the possibility of conversion through regional and municipal rabbinical authorities, and changes in the chairmanship of the committee selecting religious court judges, as well as in the body that elects the chief rabbi of Israel. All that amounts to government interference in matters of Jewish religious observance. It also implies the intention to institute civil marriage. All this would find the strongest opposition in any Knesset debates. We've got to go into a break, but keep it here, there's lots more.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel?
Shalom, I'm Natalie Sapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home every Thursday, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Welcome back. Much is being written and discussed about the resurgence of antisemitism in the world, particularly about the calls to boycott and divest from Israel and institute sanctions against our country. So, here is some information and advice for the antisemites. Many a fake doctor has brought about the death of a patient, but one does not have to be a member of the medical profession to fraudulently pretend to have a remedy for one or another shortcoming in a particular body. Take, for instance, the body politic that has always had and will frequently have false messiahs, men and lately also women, who profess to have the answer to a nation's or even the world's ills. In Israel, such incidents are not rare. We find them even in our trades unions, where a few misguided left-wing activists are trying to poison and brainwash the large majority of working men and women into believing that the scourge of Muslim extremism and terrorism can be eradicated simply by solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that if yet another Arab state is brought into existence, then the Islamic steamroller will run out of steam. Nothing is further from the truth. In the UK, the National Union of Journalists, the Transport and General Workers Union, and the University and College Union in Britain believe that by a campaign to boycott Israel and goods produced there will bring about a change in the Middle East, that Israel would be isolated, considered a pariah state, and suffer economically, as was the case in South Africa. Interestingly, their utterances on Zimbabwe, where as a result of the dispossession of the white farmers, the country is now on the verge of total economic collapse, that pales into insignificance compared with the condemnation of Israel, which is among the technologically most advanced nations in the world and a leader in ID technology, competing with Silicon Valley. Then there is our new government of change, whose leaders were so keen to attain power that they enticed an Arab party to join them to make up the numbers, even at disproportionate cost. As one of my radio listeners commented, there is an Arabic proverb which says, "My brother and I against my cousin and I against the stranger," which means blood is thicker than water. The familial or tribal bonds of the oh-so-friendly Arab leader will always be stronger than bonds of expediency. He has already stated, "We are part of the Palestinian people," an overt Trojan horse. If successful, the BDS boycotts, divestments and sanctions campaigns advocated by the Israel haters, or more correctly anti-Semites, would bring with it unimaginable damage to their own country's economy and health services. Let's consider just some of the consequences. Israel, the 100th smallest country with less than 1,000th of the world's population, can lay claim to an astounding number of advances in almost every field. WorldNet Daily contributed to the next two sentences. You would have to throw away most of your laptops, PCs and mobile phones because Intel's new multi-core processor was completely developed at facilities in Israel. And our ubiquitous mobile phone was developed in Israel by Motorola, which has its largest development center in our little land. Voice over Internet Protocol, VOIP, technology was also pioneered in Israel. In a rare public comment on the value of Israel's work in helping to make Microsoft what it is, Bill Gates said that Israeli developments in tech areas like analytics and security were improving the world, and he called Israel a major player in the high-tech world. Several of Windows operating systems were developed by Microsoft Israel. The Pentium MMX chip technology was designed in Israel at Intel, and both Microsoft and Cisco built their only R&D facilities outside the US in Israel. And with more than 3,000 high-tech companies and startups, Israel has the highest concentration of high-tech companies in the world outside Silicon Valley. In 2019, there were over 8.2% of Israel's workforce employed in technical professions. In 2016, the latest year for which occupational employment statistics survey data are available in the USA, 4.9% of the total workforce were employed in science and technology. Israel occupies first place in this category as well. AirTrain, the 8.1-mile light rail labyrinth that connects JFK Airport to New York City's mass transit is protected by Israeli-developed Nextiva surveillance system, not to speak of Israel's expertise in anti-terrorist security, sought after everywhere. In the medical field, Israeli researchers have discovered the molecular trigger that causes psoriasis, developed the express shunt to provide relief for glaucoma sufferers, unveiled a blood test that diagnoses heart attacks by telephone, and found a combination of electrical stimulation and chemotherapy that makes cancerous metastases disappear, and developed the first fully computerized, no radiation diagnostic instrumentation for breast cancer. Israel designed the first flight systems to protect passenger and freighter aircraft against missile attacks, developed the first ingestible video camera, so small it fits inside a pill, used to view the small intestines from the inside, enabling doctors to diagnose cancer and digestive disorders. Israel perfected a new device that directly helps the heart pump blood, an innovation with the potential to save lives among those with congestive heart failure, synchronizing the heart's mechanical operations through a sophisticated system of sensors, and lots more. Of course, those boycott calls are not only an anti-Israel campaign, but by their very nature are anti-Semitic. The much-respected late Ann Landers, who for 45 years wrote a syndicated column in many newspapers across America, once reminded her readers that it's a free world and you don't have to like Jews if you don't want to. But if you are going to be an anti-Semite, you should be consistent and turn your back on the medical advances that Jews have made possible. So go ahead and boycott all medicines that were researched and developed by Jews. Let me just list a few. The vaccine for hepatitis discovered by Baruch Bloomberg. Belashik developed the first diagnostic test for diphtheria. The Wassermann test for syphilis, developed by August von Wassermann, and the first effective drug to fight that disease, developed by Paul Ehrlich. Insulin would not have been discovered if Oskar Minkowski had not demonstrated a link between diabetes and the pancreas. It was Beryl Krohn who identified the disease that bears his name. And Alfred Hess discovered that vitamin C could cure scurvy. Casimir Funk was the first to use vitamin B to treat beriberi, an inflammation of the nerves that can cause heart failure, and Jonas Salk developed the first polio vaccine, and later Albert Sabin perfected the oral version. And these are just some of the medicines developed by Jews. Humanitarianism requires us to offer these gifts to all peoples of the world, regardless of race, color, or creed. Anti-Semites who want to boycott these gifts can go ahead and turn them down. But I suspect that when it comes to their own health and survival, their principles fly out of the window. So what's the point of all this? Simply that the very idea of eradicating or even displacing Israel from its historic home is suicidal to the rest of the world, not just her Arab neighbors. U.S. trade unions, including the American postal workers and Teamsters, have attacked their British counterparts for planning to boycott Israel. In a strongly worded statement, they wrote, "Imagine a world today that never knew Israel." Signed by over 20 representatives from trade unions, it said, "Rather than divestment from Israel, we believe that investment of time, energy, and material is the best means to alleviate the ongoing suffering of Palestinians and Israelis." They further slammed plans for any academic boycott, stating, Rather than limiting interactions with Israeli educators, academics, and educational institutions, we see the importance of maximizing, rather than prescribing, the free flow of ideas and academic interaction between peoples, cultures, religions, and countries. Now stop for just a second and imagine a world that never knew Israel. And then go further and imagine what our world would be like if Israel's enemies held sway. The answer follows after the break, so don't go away.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I am Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country from Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Nice to have you back. Now stop for just a second and imagine a world that never knew Israel. And then go further and imagine what our world would be like if Israel's enemies held sway. Would you rather live in Iran, Iraq, Syria, or Hamastan? Or in Israel, the only democratic state in the Middle East? That is emphasized by the AFL-CIO, the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations, representing more than 12.5 million American working people in the largest federation of trades unions in the United States. It is made up of 55 national and international unions. Its president, Richard Trumka, said about Israel, "So long as I am president, you will never have a stronger ally than the AFL-CIO. Who needs Israel? Let's be honest, everyone does. We just celebrated the beginning of the month of Tammuz. As usual, and as they try to do every new month, the organization Women of the Wall once again disrupted the decorum at the Western Wall by trying to defy the regulations and bring their own Torah scroll into the prayer area. That caused a serious disturbance with shouting and even pushing of ordinary worshippers who objected to the noise. The Women of the Wall, known as WOW, are advocating to be allowed to hold their own service within the women's section of the Western Wall. On previous occasions, it's been shown that their noisy performance is disturbing the devotion of the regular attenders. The WOW, in what seems to be a mockery of the religious ritual incumbent upon men, appear wearing prayer shawls and phylacteries. Rather than serious prayer, their performance is a political demonstration to try and turn the main Western Wall prayer area into a unisex service, contrary to religious law. It is noteworthy that there already exists a family area in a different section of the same wall where the Reform Movement can hold their services. The WOW refuse to accept this. I just wonder whether in the rest of their lives they fulfill all the other religious obligations that are incumbent upon Jewish women. It is now high time that instead of efforts to simply prevent these disturbances in the future, heavy fines should be imposed, as would be the case, for offenses of disturbing the peace at other locations. Since I began compiling this program, the new so-called government of change has begun to show its real colors. The change is far from what was expected of the new prime minister. Naftali Bennett has betrayed his voters and is acting as a fig leaf for the new left-wing policies. To placate his religious critics, he published a picture on social media showing that he knows how to wear prayer shawl and phylacteries. As he professes to be Torah observant, it must be assumed that he does this on every weekday, so what's the point? It must be considered as a political stunt to try and show that he balances his secular companion Yair Lapid with what has since proved false. It's rather birds of a feather flock together. The picture shows him with his eyes closed, trying to imply devotion. But he also seemed to have his eyes closed when he joined with his present left-wing and Arab partners. How else could he place himself at the head of a government that contradicts his professed right-wing views, a government that will lay the foundations for a Palestinian state? The leader of the United Arab List, Mansour Abbas, a minister in the government, has already declared, "I'm a Palestinian and we will reclaim the lands that were expropriated from our people. This is a national cause of the first degree." In what I consider to have been an insult to the Knesset, he spoke those words in Arabic before switching to Hebrew and continuing his address to the Knesset plenum in a less confrontational tone. "I said it before and I say it again, we have an Arab Trojan horse in this government that has already made concessions and will concede more to the Arabs that will damage our country." In the past, the complaints were that the religious parties held the balance of power. Today, it's Mansour Abbas and his Arab Ram Party. Which is less harmful to the fabric of our country? A Jewish religious viewpoint or an Arab confrontational one? By the way, the new government was sworn in with the narrowest of narrow majority votes of one. The outgoing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cannot be written off. As a leader of the opposition, he still holds sway among the political right. He is a master of political manipulation. Although no longer supported by a Knesset speaker from Likud, the party he leads, Netanyahu will make every effort to sort disunity among and within the government parties. He considers the new government legal but illegitimate, particularly the new prime minister, whose party Yamina commands just 6 seats in a parliament of 120. Although Bennett and Lapid planned on a smaller government, they have appointed 27 ministers from 8 parties. Unfortunately, in Israel, politicians trade their vote for ministerial posts. Policies matter less. A government composed of 8 parties can impossibly last a full term of 4 years. It would be a miracle were it to survive beyond the end of this year. While large celebrations kept central Tel Aviv awake into the night, Jerusalem's population went about their business as if nothing had happened. The installation of Mickey Levy as new Knesset speaker caused less than a ripple in Israel's capital. No doubt in Tehran there was joy, and Hamas and Hezbollah probably handed out sweet confection. Now, here's some news from the UK. For the second time this month, a convoy of cars drove through a Jewish area in London, draped with Palestinian flags and targeting kippah-wearing Jews with anti-Semitic abuse. The police conditions for the second march was not to shout offensive language. On the first occasion, they called to kill Jews and rape their daughters. There is a thin line between free speech and provocative action that needs to be examined by the courts. A headline in one of the 2 major national Jewish newspapers, the Jewish News, read, "Israel's new progressive government is a triumph for democracy." Well, it certainly came into existence legally, but their declared policies are far from democratic. That government has no authority to unilaterally upturn long-standing Jewish religious laws in our Jewish state, as is their intention. The resignation from the British Labour Party of 7 former members of parliament because of rampant anti-Semitism is still making headlines. The former leader of the party, Jeremy Corbyn, is known to be a rabid anti-Semite. He's been accused by Luciana Berger, one of the 7, to have shouted foul language at her and to have been instrumental in hounding her out of the party. One complaint demanded the party prioritize an investigation into whether Corbyn himself knew of any plan to hound out MPs that was run from the leader of the opposition's office. The current leader of the Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer, admitted that Labour has still further to go in tackling anti-Semitism within his party. He said, "I don't think anyone could put their hand on their heart and say Keir Starmer is not taking anti-Semitism in the Labour Party seriously." I wonder how much longer it will take for Jews in Britain to burst the bubble with which they have surrounded themselves and realize that anti-Semitism is on the rise and that their quality of life will in due course be affected. As of now, they believe that the current level of Jew hatred is acceptable, weighed against their business opportunities. That was precisely the view held by German Jews in the early 30s. I've often said that anti-Semitism today is comparable with its demonstration in the early 1930s, and were it not for the existence of the State of Israel, the picture would be even worse. Precisely because of Israel, the situation will never attain the culmination that it did under the Nazis. However, on present evidence, its manifestation will reach an intolerable level not conducive to an atmosphere in which to raise Jewish children. Sooner or later, Jews in Britain, including my family, will have to realize that despite Israel's perceived shortcomings, the children will enjoy their youth in Israel free from the inevitable shadow of anti-Semitism. For their sake, make the decision. Keep it here. You wouldn't want to miss what's coming after the break.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa, and each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Sometimes something happens that doesn't turn out as expected and that should make the headlines, but for all sorts of reasons is overlooked or even deliberately ignored by most of the media. It could be because just at the same time there is a major disaster somewhere in the world or a great ceremonial event is taking place, or even the time when an election result is declared in one or another country and is analyzed in great detail. All the news stories as we say in journalism, have legs. In other words, can be milked for some time and will therefore attract advertising in the various news outlets. But sometimes there are political reasons to prevent publicity, as in the story that I want to share with you today. A story that was, in my opinion, if not the greatest, but certainly one of the most noteworthy of recent years. Student debates at the major universities in the US or UK have often caused reverberations far beyond the debating chamber, as for instance the famous Oxford Union debate of 1939, whether to fight for king and country. Some time ago, there was a debate at the prestigious Students' Union of the University of Cambridge in England, the equivalent of a senior Ivy League university in the US, and the motion was, "This House believes that Israel is a rogue state." Nothing really surprising in today's climate, and it was expected to be another hostile event, denouncing the Jewish state. Proposing the motion was Lauren Booth, the anti-Israel activist, convert to Islam, passenger on the famous Turkish flotilla, and sister-in-law of former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Also speaking for the motion was Mark MacDonald, the founder of the group Labour Friends of Palestine, and Gabriel Latner, a 19-year-old second-year law student from Toronto. Opposing the motion were Ran Gidor, the Israeli embassy's counselor for political affairs, Shiraz Maher, a former Islamic extremist, and Rob Mindell, an ex-president of Cambridge University's Jewish Society. The debate caused such a stir that it was widely discussed by bloggers and generated many messages on social networking sites like Facebook. As a result of Gabriel Latner's speech, remember he was one of the proposers of the motion that Israel is a rogue state, it was decisively defeated with 74% of the votes opposing it. So despite losing it, Latner won it for Israel. The Jerusalem Post's London correspondent Johnny Paul reports that Latner, who comes from a Reconstructionist Jewish background and has been to Israel several times, responded to a general student union request for members to participate in the debate, and he was invited to appear for the proposers of the motion. Latner delivered a 10-minute speech to the 800-strong audience that defied all expectation. Interestingly, he was not required to submit it in advance. You will be spellbound by the text, which I have decided to read in full. As much as this live stream program permits, but all of it will be posted on the podcast on our website. Quote, "This is a war of ideals, and the other speakers here tonight are rightfully idealists. I am not. I am a realist. I am here to win. I have a single goal this evening, to have at least a plurality of you walk out of the yes door. I face a singular challenge. Most, if not all of you, have already made up your minds. This issue is too polarizing for the vast majority of you not to already have a set opinion. I'd be willing to bet that half of you strongly support the motion and half of you strongly oppose it. I want to win and we are destined for a tie. I'm tempted to do what my fellow speakers are going to do, simply rehash every bad thing that Israel's government has ever done in an attempt to satisfy those of you who agree with them. And perhaps even guilt one of you, rare undecided, into voting for the opposition, or more accurately, against Israel. It would be so easy to twist the meaning and the significance of international laws to make Israel look like a criminal state. But that's been done to death. It would be easier still to play to your sympathy with personalized stories of Palestinian suffering, and they can give very eloquent speeches on those issues. But the truth is that treating people badly, whether they're your citizens or an occupied nation, does not make a state rogue. If it did, Canada, the US, and Australia would be rogue states based on how they treat their indigenous population. Britain's treatment of the Irish would easily qualify them to wear this sobriquet. These arguments, while emotionally satisfying, lack intellectual rigor. More importantly, I just don't think we can win with those arguments. It won't change the numbers. Half of you will agree with them, half of you won't. So I'm going to try something different, something a little unorthodox. I'm going to try and convince the diehard Zionists and Israel supporters here tonight to vote for the proposition. By the end of my speech, I will have presented 5 pro-Israel arguments that show Israel, if not a rogue state, then at least roguish. Let me be clear. I will not be arguing that Israel is bad. I will not be arguing that it doesn't deserve to exist. I won't be arguing that it behaves worse than every other country. I will only be arguing that Israel is rogue. The word rogue has come to have exceptionally damning connotations, but the word itself is value neutral. The Oxford English Dictionary defines rogue as aberrant, anomalous, misplaced, occurring especially in isolation at an unexpected place of time. While a dictionary from a far greater institution gives this definition, behaving in ways that are not expected or not normal, often in a destructive way. These definitions and others center on the idea of anomaly, the unexpected or uncommon. Using this definition, a rogue state is one that acts in an unexpected, uncommon, or aberrant manner, a state that behaves exactly like Israel. The first argument is statistical. The fact that Israel is a Jewish state alone makes it anomalous enough to be dubbed a rogue state. There are 195 countries in the world. Some are Christian, some Muslim, some are secular. Israel is the only country in the world that is Jewish. Or to speak mathmo for a moment, the chance of any randomly chosen state being Jewish is 0.0051%. In comparison to the chance of a UK lotto ticket winning at least £10 is 0.017%, more than twice as likely. Israel's Jewishness is a statistical aberration. The second argument concerns humanitarianism, in particular Israel's response to a refugee crisis. Not the Palestinian refugee crisis, for I'm sure that the other speakers will cover that, but the issue of Darfurian refugees. Everyone knows that what is happening and is still happening in Darfur is genocide, whether or not the UN and the Arab League will call it such. There's been a mass exodus from Darfur as the oppressed seek safety. They've not had much luck. Many have gone north to Egypt, where they are treated despicably. The brave make a run through the desert in a bid to make it to Israel. Not only do they face the natural threats of the Sinai, they are often used for target practice by the Egyptian soldiers patrolling the border. Why would they take the risk? Because in Israel they are treated with compassion, they are treated as the refugees that they are, and perhaps Israel's cultural memory of genocide is to blame. The Israeli government has even gone so far as to grant several hundred Darfurian refugees citizenship. This alone sets Israel apart from the rest of the world. But the real point of distinction is this. The IDF, The Israel Defense Forces sends out soldiers and medics to patrol the Egyptian border. They are sent looking for refugees attempting to cross into Israel, not to send them back into Egypt, but to save them from dehydration, heat exhaustion, and Egyptian bullets. Compare that to the US's reaction to illegal immigration across the border with Mexico. The American government has arrested private individuals for giving water to border crossers who were dying of thirst. And here, the Israeli government is sending out its soldiers to save illegal immigrants. To call that sort of behavior anomalous is an understatement. My third argument is that the Israeli government engages in an activity which the rest of the world shuns. It negotiates with terrorists. Forget the late PLO chairman Yasser Arafat, a man who died with blood all over his hands. They're in the process of negotiating with terrorists as we speak. Yasser Abed Rabo is one of the lead PLO negotiators that has been sent to the peace talks with Israel. Abed Rabo also used to be a leader of the PFLP, an organization of freedom fighters, that under Abed Rabo's leadership engaged in such freedom-promoting activities as killing 22 Israeli high school students. And the Israeli government is sending delegates to sit at the table with this man and talk about peace. And the world applauds. You would never see the Spanish government in peace talks with the leaders of the ETA. The British government would never negotiate with Thomas Murphy. And if President Obama were to sit down and talk about peace with Osama bin Laden, the world would view this as insanity. But Israel can do the exact same thing and earn international praise in the process. That is the dictionary definition of rogue, behaving in a way that is unexpected or not normal. Another part of dictionary definition is behavior or activity occurring at an unexpected place or time. When you compare Israel to its regional neighbors, it becomes clear just how roguish Israel is. And here is the fourth argument. Israel has a better human rights record than any of its neighbors. At no point in history has there ever been a liberal democratic state in the Middle East, except for Israel. Of all the countries in the Middle East, Israel is the only one where the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community enjoys a measure of equality. In Kuwait, Lebanon, Oman, Qatar, and Syria, homosexual conduct is punishable by flogging, imprisonment, or both. But homosexuals there get off pretty lightly compared to their counterparts in Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen, who are put to death. Israeli homosexuals can adopt and openly serve in the army, enter civil unions, and are protected by exceptionally strongly worded anti-discrimination legislation. Beats a death sentence. In fact, it beats America. Israel's protection of its citizens' civil liberties has earned international recognition. Freedom House is an NGO that releases an annual report on democracy and civil liberties in each of the 195 countries in the world. It ranks each as free, partly free, or not free. In the Middle East, Israel is the only country that has earned designation as a free country. Not surprising, given the level of freedom afforded to citizens in, say, Lebanon, a country designated partly free, where there are laws against reporters criticizing not only the Lebanese government, but the Syrian regime as well. Iran is a country given the rating of not free, putting it alongside China, Zimbabwe, North Korea, and Myanmar. In Iran, there's a special press court which prosecutes journalists for such heinous offenses as criticizing the Ayatollah or reporting on stories damaging the foundations of the Islamic Republic, using suspicious, i.e. Western sources, or insulting Islam. Iran is the world leader in terms of jailed journalists, with 39 reporters that we know of in prison as of 2009. They also kicked out almost every Western journalist during the 2009 election. I guess we can't really expect more from a theocracy, which is what most countries in the Middle East are. Theocracies and autocracies. But Israel is the sole, the only, the rogue democracy. Out of every country in the Middle East, only in Israel do anti-government protests and reporters go unsquashed and uncensored. I have one final argument. The last nail in the opposition's coffin, and it's sitting right across the aisle, Mr. Ran Gidor's presence here is the only evidence any of us should need to confidently call Israel a rogue state. For those of you who have never heard of him, Mr. Gidor is a political counselor attached to the Israeli embassy in London. He's the guy the Israeli government sent to represent them to the UN. He knows what he's doing, and he's here tonight. And it's incredible. Consider for a moment what his presence here means. The Israeli government has signed off to allow one of their senior diplomatic representatives to participate in a debate on their very legitimacy. That's remarkable. Do you think for a minute that any other country would do the same? If the Yale University Debating Society were to have a debate where the motion was, "This House believes Britain is a racist, totalitarian state that has done irrevocable harm to peoples in the world," that Britain would allow any of its officials to participate? No. Would China participate in a debate about the status of Taiwan? Never. And there is no chance in hell that the American government official would ever be permitted to argue in a debate concerning its treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. But Israel has sent Mr. Ran Gidor to argue tonight against a 19-year-old law student who's entirely unqualified to speak on the issue at hand. Every government in the world should be laughing at Israel right now because it forgot rule number one. You never add credence to crackpots by engaging with them. It's the same reason you won't see Stephen Hawking or Richard Dawkins debate David Icke. But Israel is doing precisely that. Once again, behaving in a way that is unexpected or not normal. Behaving like a rogue state. That's five arguments that have been direct at the supporters of Israel. But I have a minute or two left, and here's an argument for all of you. Israel willfully and forcefully disregards international law. In 1981, Israel destroyed Osirak, Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb lab. Every government in the world knew that Hassan was building a bomb, and they did nothing, except for Israel. Yes, in doing so, they broke international law and custom, but they also saved us all from a nuclear Iraq. That rogue nation should earn Israel a place of respect in the eyes of all freedom-loving peoples, but it hasn't. But tonight, while you listen to us prattle on, I want you to remember something while you're here. Khomeini's Iran is working towards the bomb. And if you're honest with yourself, you know that Israel is the only country that can and will do something about it. Israel will, out of necessity, act in a way that is not the norm. And you'd better hope that they do it in a destructive manner. Any sane person would rather a rogue Israel than a nuclear Iran. By the motion being defeated, Israel won. I believe that this young man will go far in his chosen profession as a lawyer. I hope that you were as amazed by the way this young man developed his argument as I was. And now I come to the end of the program. I hope to be back again next week, same time, same place, with another selection of news, views, and interviews from Israel and the rest of the Jewish world. Until then, this is Walter Bingham wishing you a good and safe week. And please visit your elderly neighbor. Make sure that he or she has what they need. Goodbye.
Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com homepage, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us.
We love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.